Thursday, 10 March. Sheriff had a shakeout. Searched through all the cells and found a shiv tucked under D's mattress. Wonder what he had in mind. Smile. Not that Perry really considered it a smiling matter, for Dick, flourishing a dangerous weapon, could have played a decisive role in plans he himself was forming. As the weeks went by, he had become familiar with life on Courthouse Square, its habitués and their habits. The cats, for example. The two thin gray toms who appeared with every twilight and prowled the square, stopping to examine the cars parked around its periphery. Behavior puzzling to him until Mrs. Meyer explained that the cats were hunting for dead birds caught in the vehicle's engine grills. Thereafter, it pained him to watch their maneuvers. Because most of my life, I've done what they're doing. The equivalent. And there was one man of whom Perry had grown especially aware. A robust, upright gentleman with hair like a gray and silver skullcap. His face, filled out, firm-jawed, was somewhat cantankerous in repose. The mouth down-curved, the eyes downcast as though in mirthless reverie. A picture of unsparing sternness. And yet this was at least a partially inaccurate impression, for now and again the prisoner glimpsed him as he paused to talk to other men, joke with them and laugh, and then he seemed carefree, jovial, generous. The kind of person who might see the human side. An important attribute, for the man was Roland H. Tate, judge of the 32nd Judicial District, the jurist who would preside at the trial of the state of Kansas versus Smith and Hickok. Tate, as Perry soon learned, was an old and awesome name in western Kansas. The judge was rich. He raised horses. He owned much land, and his wife was said to be very beautiful. He was the father of two sons, but the younger had died. A tragedy that greatly affected the parents and led them to adopt a small boy who had appeared in court as an abandoned, homeless child. "He sounds soft-hearted to me," Perry once said to Mrs. Meyer. "Maybe he'll give us a break." But that was not what Perry really believed. He believed what he'd written Don Cullivan, with whom he now corresponded regularly. His crime was unforgivable, and he fully expected to climb those 13 steps. However, he was not altogether without hope, for he too had plotted an escape. It depended upon a pair of young men that he had often observed observing him. One was red-haired, the other dark. Sometimes, standing in the square under the tree that touched the cell window, they smiled and signaled to him. Or so he imagined.